so yes, I'm now a data scientist, and I wanted to spend an hour telling you guys about the kind of stuff you do in data, in big data. This is a very high-level talk. You're not going to go out and write MapReduce jobs for Netflix at the end of this talk, but you're going to get a sense of what kind of thing is involved. And I just wanted to throw one last thing in, which is that I do work in Occupy Wall Street now, and my group came out with a book recently. I've got 3 more copies of the book if anybody wants them. It's basically Introduction to the Financial System from the Point of View of the 99%. But I'll stop that with that, and I'll start talking about this. I've been giving a talk this year called Weapons of Mass Destruction, which I decided not to give now. This is just really a straight up, data's awesome, math modeling is fun, let's think about how we do these things. So the references are the a data science book that I'm writing. It's coming out in a week with O'Reilly, with my co-author Rachel. It's based on a class that she taught at Columbia a year ago that I blogged on MathBabe, so you can see the first generation of the chapters on my blog. There's a page dedicated to that. And there's also a paper I've been reading, which I find fascinating, written by the guys who basically developed the first iteration of Google News, which you probably have used. So the first part of my talk is just going to tell you an overview of what each... So I'm going to tell you about 3 different recommendation systems and give you an idea of what the mathematics behind it is. And everybody here in the audience is at a different level. I know that you guys are all math enthusiasts, and that's awesome. I'm not going to be able to explain these very deeply, but I want to give you a sense. Even so, please do ask a question if you think I've tried to explain something that you almost get, but not quite. Then I'll do my best. So before I go on, I want to tell you what a recommendation system is. It's the thing that tells you, here's what you might want to try next. And you see it in Netflix for movies. You see it in Spotify for songs. You see it in Pandora for songs. You see it in Google News for news articles. And you actually don't see it, but it's there for lots of things like Amazon when they decide what ads to show, because they are customizing the ads to you. Sometimes it's a segmentation model, which is sometimes a straight up regression, but often it's a recommendation engine. So basically it's saying, it's answering the following question: knowing your history, what might please you? And please, we can talk at the end whether please is the right word, especially when it comes to ads. So one thing I want to mention is that you need a lot of data to make these things work. A lot of data on a lot of people. And so that's the second part of my talk, which is how do you deal with massive amounts of data when it goes from data you can put on your computer to data that is way too big for your computer. And that's where the big data comes in. So there's 3 models I want to talk about. The first one's called latent factor analysis. And the idea, the very high level of idea is, we've noticed you like sentimental movies. Here's a sentimental movie. Okay. Now the caveat that the factors are like the categories, basically. Sentimentality. We noticed you like violent movies. Here's a violent movie. Actually, you have a violent movie score of 8 out of 10. You have a sentimental movie score of 3 out of 10. It's not that it's 1 or 0, right? It's like you have a score for each of some various factors. We don't actually know the factors. That's another way I'm lying. It's you just choose the number of factors. The model figures out what they are. And you might sometimes be able to interpret them, sometimes you won't. Co-visitation is the second model I'm going to talk about. That is based on the idea that there's lots of people out there. We can figure out what you're going to like because other people have looked at a lot of the same stuff you've looked at and some other stuff you haven't looked at. You might want to look at that other stuff. And then finally, topic analysis, which is often used in news, is based on the idea you have been reading a lot about financial regulation, if you're me. Here's some financial regulation news that you're going to be interested in. So let's first dive into factor analysis a little bit. The basic, I'm going to give a little notation. Think of U as your users and V as the items. And actually, these look like sets right now. I'm going to absolutely betray all notation standards and call them, they're going to end up being matrices in a few seconds. But for now that they're sets with nodes in them, each node here is a user and each node over there is an item, you're going to realize that the general thing, movies, whatever, news articles, the general thing is that each user has had interaction with some number of items. If it's news articles, it's just one or zero. I've either read it or I haven't. That's all I've kept track of. Nobody can tell if you liked the news article. But if it's Netflix, you might have actually said, I like this, 5 stars. So you can think of each edge here as a meaning that there was an interaction, and there could be labels if you have a score on it. Or if it's like news, it's just the label could be just one or zero. Or just be one, in fact, because the things that you're, there's no arrow, there's no edge between a user and something you haven't interacted with. So almost all of these examples I'm going to give, you should think about, there are lots of users and lots of items, but most of the time users only interact with a very small number of the items. Like, we don't read all of the news articles that are in Google News. There's no way. There's a very small actual set that you interact with. We also have other kinds of data about you. We might have, like, we might have asked you to sign in, and we might have information about you. That's called metadata, and we will think of those as items as well. So we'll just throw them in as items, and the label on that edge will be your age. That label on that edge will be male or female. Does that make sense? So we just throw them in as extra items. And if you look here, you see that. That's why I have the top three. Everyone's touching the top three because we know everyone's age, we know everyone's gender, et cetera. And then what you do is you make a huge matrix of all this stuff. Here's what it looks like. It's huge. You never actually make this matrix, but I want you to imagine this matrix. It is absolutely enormous because it has you have the users corresponding to each row and the items corresponding to each column. And you have the numbers you actually know. If you know the labels, they're usually scores. We're going to think of them as scores from 1 to 5 right now. Then you throw them in if you know them. If it's age, you could have 5 buckets of age. You know, it could be 1 through 5 buckets of age. So you're going to make everything 1 through 5, except most of the time you don't know anything. So it's a very sparse matrix. And the question is, how do you find values you don't know? That's what you mean to recommend something, right? What it means to recommend saying something is like, oh, well, this user liked this item? We don't know. How are we going to figure that out? What number should go there? What's our best guess for the number that should go there? The first thing you might want to try is just linear regression straight up. And I'm just throwing out this equation for it. You say, for a fixed user I and a fixed item j, you might just want to run a linear regression and hear the coefficients and see whether that works. Well, the good news is, if you try a linear regression, is that it's a closed form solution. You just have, it's a really simple solution to solve a linear regression. You just have to invert a little matrix. Depending on how many items you have, that could be a lot, but it's at least closed form. The bad news is that you're not really sharing, if you stare at that, you're going to see you're not sharing information between items. What you're saying is, at the end of the day, what you're going to get is like, well, take this person's rating times 0.5 plus this person's rating times 0.6, and you're going to get your guess at your rating. Okay? That's the kind of thing that would solve. But there's a lot of missing items as well. And that's a problem for linear regression. There's also a lot, there's so much missing items that it causes huge coefficients when there's linear dependencies, and the way you try to solve missing items problems creates dependencies and you get huge coefficients. You can try to solve this, but you'd be creating other problems. So we're not going to do that, but I did want to mention that because we're going to come back to that. So let's go back to our original problem, is trying to find the entries, the empty things, the empty spaces inside this huge matrix. So this is the information we know, this is the information we have to guess. And we're going to use a trick, which is called, it's called singular value decomposition. And what it means is, it's basically decomposing your huge matrix into eigenspaces and how you have eigenvalues. But if you ignore that for a second, you can think of, it's just, you can write your huge matrix X, actually not your matrix, a matrix because your matrix doesn't have a lot of entries. So that's a little tricky. But a matrix that, of the entries that it, you do have, looks a lot like these entries. So we usually maybe call it X prime. But you can take any matrix X and you can write it in this form, and you can actually think of the U here as a matrix whose rows correspond to your users, and V as the matrix whose rows correspond to items, and the S is a diagonal. And I'm going to draw another picture of it. Here's the picture of SVD. You have S, which is diagonal of the rank of the matrix X. And these are the actual eigenvalues, and they typically get, and you can order them. You can change of basis, up to a change of basis, you can order these from big to small. And what you see when you do lots of data analysis is that it starts out really big and gets small really quickly. Okay, so what? Why am I telling you about this decomposition of any matrix X? Because there's a trick, which is that if you wanted to approximate X, instead of having the whole X, which I just showed you is pretty complicated, to approximate it, you don't need all of those eigenvalues. You can get rid of all the small ones, and you get something that has a very good approximation to X. The number of numbers you choose we're going to call it D. That's a parameter. And that's going to be the number of factors you think about. Remember when we talked about what this was supposed to be? We're saying violence of the movies, sentimentality of the movies. Those are factors. And we're going to choose the most important factors, and we're going to be thinking about in terms of the eigenvalues. So actually, the way this works is you kind of ignore the diagonal part, but you're actually doing that, what I just said. You can think of the diagonal as sort of squeezed out to both U and V, but what you're really doing in this actual algorithm, which is called alternating least squares, is you're factoring your big matrix X, or actually an approximation to that X, as a product of two matrices, where the rows, again, the same thing, rows are corresponding to the user's U, and the number of columns is just that number of factors D. So it's actually a really tall, skinny matrix. Each row is a person, and how many columns? Just the number of factors you care about, which, by the way, is 20. It's strange, but, and it's kind of sad. It's a statement about the human condition, but we basically only have 20 dimensions of taste. We actually only have 20 dimensions of anything. Like, I didn't actually learn this from somebody who's doing movies. I learned this algorithm from somebody who does something called hunch.com, where they ask you a bunch of questions about yourself. Like, are you male, female? Do you like tea or coffee? Dog person, cat person? Who knows what they ask? They ask 20 questions, then they know everything about you. It's really embarrassing. But that's what they said. They like, well, 20 questions, we pretty much know you. I'm kind of embarrassed, but that's the way it is. So you have a long, skinny column matrix, and you have another one here for the items. Again, just D. And when you multiply this out, you don't get X back. You get something close to X, depending on how big D is. And again, D is 20. But you get to choose D. I mean, you could make D 100, but you're not gaining that much. You're getting a little bit more information. There might be strange weirdos who you need 24 questions to know. So my example is sexiness. I don't know why, but certain things are... So the idea of this is, like, you're trying to understand everyone's sexiness score. How much do you care about sexiness in your movies? It's hard to define exactly. It's actually a combination of various other things, which is why when you say you want 20 factors, you don't even know what the factor is. It could be sexiness, but how do you even quantify that? Well, this is a way of quantifying it. It's not totally prescriptive. Like, you know, I might look at that column and say, you know, given which movies score high on sexiness, because that's what you do, that's how you interpret these things, because both users and movies have scores for sexiness scores, or a given factor scores, but I'm focusing on sexiness. So you get to decide what it means. For these movies have high sexiness score, these movies don't, and then you're like, oh, that must be what sexiness is. Of course, sexiness only becomes a factor if it's an important thing about the human condition, which we decided probably true. Okay, so just to be clear, this is actually really cool in the sense that if you take a column, just to think about how easy this is, if you take a column for the user and a row for a user and a row for an item, and you take the dot product, you get the best guess as to the score for that user and that item. very simple. And the alternating least squares algorithm I'm just about to describe is just the difference, the square difference, between that predicted value and the actual value, summed over all the values you actually have. And the idea is you can optimize for this. You can minimize this error. And the way you do it is you start with some crappy version of V with just random numbers in it, not too large, and then you fix V and optimize U. Remember, there's two big matrices, items and users. You fix V, optimize U, and then you assume that U is perfect, and you optimize V. And what you're doing every time is you're actually doing a linear regression. And if you actually think about what you're doing, you are just saying that when you optimize, fixing V and optimizing U, you're saying you're just regressing only on those movies that user has seen. So it's actually a pretty small calculation. Because as we said, a given user doesn't rate that many users. So the smallness is going to come back. Let's talk about co-visitation next. That's the next algorithm I want to talk about. And recall, it's the one where if I write a lot of articles that Rebecca's read, then you might want to tell me another thing that Rebecca's read. And what we're actually going to do is we're going to create clusters of users and see what they read, and then say, well, you're in a cluster. I'm going to give you the ranking of these people in this cluster, the highest ranked thing that you haven't read. That's going to be the algorithm. But how do you set that up? Well, you identify a user with its history, their history. Now, this is just a vector of ones and zeros. There's an entry for every news item. I'm going to think about these news as articles now. And there's very, very few ones. There's mostly zeros, right? And then I'm going to define the similarity between me and someone else, me and Rebecca, by looking at how many news articles we've read in common divided by how many we've read altogether between the two of us. Okay, well, that's actually turns out to be a pretty cool measurement of similarity between people. And one minus that is, in fact, a distance function. So what we really want to do is we want to find that similarity between me and everyone else in the world. But that's actually a lot of work. If you think about how much work that is, that's a lot of work. So we're going to do something tricky to avoid doing that, and it's called a min-hash. And the idea is we're going to map each user to a 64-bit number, and there's going to be collisions. More than one person is going to be hitting that same number under that map, which I'm going to describe in a second, if we are similar. In fact, the probability of us hitting that number is going to be our similarity score. So here's what we're going to do. Let's say I've read some number of articles. I've got a bunch of ones in my vector. What we're going to do is we're going to randomize all the articles in the world that are in our universe, and we're going to put them in order. We're going to randomize their order. And then we're going to take Rebecca and my numbers. We now have some numbers, some of those we've read, right? And we're going to see, we're going to go from the first article. Did either one of them read this one? No? Okay, move on. Either one of them read this? No, move on. Until we find the smallest number that one of us has read. And then, if both of us have read it, then the likelihood, sorry, I want to make the point that the likelihood of the collision is going to be, of colliding on that number, is going to be just our distance. Didn't say that well. So we're going to order the story. What's the likelihood that the first one that we hit that is in common for both of our histories is the same? I'm sorry. I'm going to get back to that if I can. So how this really works is we're going to use min-hash to order the IDs. So we actually, yes, okay, sorry. I'm going to go back. I got it now. So what is the number we're mapped to? It's our smallest number after this randomization. Okay? So you randomize all the articles, and I say the map sends me to the smallest ID number for the articles I've read. Same thing for Rebecca. The chance that we're hitting the same number under that is exactly the chance that smallest one is something we've both read. Okay? So that likelihood of collision. So the point is we're doing this map and colliding, if more likely to collide, if we are more similar users. What we actually do, because look, it's still a lot of work, what I said. It's still a lot of work to permute all the articles in the world and then compute everyone's number. But what we're going to do instead, we have a way of not really randomizing it, using the seeds, and then we order the IDs that way. And then we just take the minimum instead of actually, so we only have each of us only has a very short list of things we've actually read, and then we take the minimum of both and compare them. So it's actually really fast. We're not permuting an infinite number of articles at all. So the truth is, we actually, instead of doing one story, they do a concatenation of stories. So they do maybe six stories. And then the probability isn't the same as our distance that we hit the same thing. The probability is the sixth power of our distance. That creates smaller clusters. But the clusters of people all read the same six stories. So they're more similar. Okay, does that make sense? So what you're doing is you're creating these little mini clusters of very similar users, people with very similar histories. And then you remove small clusters. I really apologize, but my alarm just went off for my son to do eye therapy. Okay, so let's talk about the last algorithm, which is latent topic analysis. And I'm going to tell about a little bit less because it's got a lot of Bayesian statistics behind it. But I want you to get the basic idea, which is this is also called collaborative filtering. You have a bunch of topics. And again, you just choose the number of topics here. The number of topics is D, just like the number of factors were D before. Same idea, too, about 20, which is another sad fact, maybe 100. So you think about the probability that a given person's interested in a topic. Of course, you can calculate that probability from the data of what they've read. What's the probability that a given topic is related to a given article? And then finally, is this the most interesting topic? And what it does is it relates these three different kinds of probabilities, and it actually adjusts the topics to be more interesting and more related to the actual data at hand. And it's iteratively computed, similar to like fixing U and optimizing V and then vice versa, but instead you use an EM algorithm. And I actually don't know what EM stands for. I feel really embarrassed. Does anybody know? Oh, okay, great. So what you're doing, expectation maximization, sorry. What you're doing is you're maximizing the conditional likelihood of all the data points given the parameters you're choosing. So you're fixing, and the parameters themselves are those probabilities I just mentioned. These probabilities that this is the right topic, that the probability, I like that topic. So, another way of saying you're minimizing the negative log likelihood. And by the way, there's this like really kind of cool little math thing, which is that it really works as well as it does because log is like concave. That's the word, concave. But the way the EM algorithm works is you alternate between adjusting the topics to be more relevant to your data set and then adjusting the probabilities that people will like those topics, and those topics will be relevant to the articles. And you keep doing that, and you're assured by the algorithm to maximize your likelihood. Okay, now we have these three algorithms. Let's apply them to this massive data set. And just think, this is more data than you could possibly fit on any of your computers. Way more. And I just want to explain what kind of thing can go wrong when you have that much data. Even when you have a stupid algorithm, and then we'll talk about having a little bit more complicated algorithm. What's the stupidest algorithm you can think of that's still an algorithm? Word frequency. You have a list of words, and you want to know how frequently you see each word in your list. It could be the encyclopedia. Right here is just this word, this list. Well, the stupidest way of dealing with this is just literally counting them by hand. Right? But if you have pages and pages of words, you might want to write an algorithm for it and just put it into your computer and have the computer do it. In fact, if you do it stupidly, which is the only way I do it, is you're actually going to store each word twice, if you think about it, if you just do a stupid Python procedure. But there are smart ways of doing this when you only store each thing once. And that allows you to do about 100 million words on a good laptop. But of course, that's only 100 million words, and there's way more than that in the corpus of the web. And this is what Google does. So how do we squeeze out more than that? Well, we can compress the words, we can use all the cores on our fancy computers. You can get up to 10 trillion words that way. But what if we have more than 10 trillion words? Because there's a lot more than 10 trillion words. Well, you can use more computers. Cool. If you have 10 more computers, think about it. You could do as much as you have 10 trillion on each computer. Then you could sort of aggregate it and send it to a master computer and then add them all up. Okay. And that would work, by the way, if there's enough repetition and you're not getting 10 different lists, right? You're getting kind of the same list with different numbers, and then you add them all up. But, yeah. That's what that says. But then here, you know, what if you have even more than 10 times 10 trillion? Well, then you can get a huge grid of computers to do this. That's a great idea. You will do that. But then computers will fail. One computer doesn't fail very likely, just a probability, epsilon. But if you have a lot of computers, you know, what's the probability? It's 1 minus epsilon to 1,000 if you have 1,000 computers. So as an example to that, if you have like 0.3% failure rate, and you have 1,000 computers, then you have 95% chance of something failing. And that means you are not going to get the right answer. So what MapReduce does, this kind of sucks. We need to deal with this. This is a robustness issue. It's about hardware. The way we solve this is called MapReduce. So MapReduce essentially allows you to stop thinking about failure. You guys just started thinking about it. I know you just started thinking about it, but you're going to stop right now. So this has been happening at Google, right? Google's been dealing with this. They're like, God, another computer failed. We could have seen that coming. It happened every day this week. So what they did was they created a mechanism whereby you gain something and you lose something. What you gain is the ability to forget about failure. What you lose is you can't just willy-nilly throw any algorithm whatsoever onto that grid. What you need to do is just set it up inside the framework of MapReduce. MapReduce framework is flexible, but it's also rigid, which doesn't make any sense, but I'll explain it. So the map step of the MapReduce takes data, performs some function, you decide what data put in, you decide what function, and then the output has to be in this form, key, comma, value. And then there's a fan in, which is when you aggregate all the things by the key. That should really be called fan in, just that first line. So all the things with the same key go to the same new computer. You should think of this all happening on a grid of computers, 1,000 computers. All the things with the same key get sent to that computer, all the things with that key get sent to that computer. And yes, if you have way too many things of one key, this could be a problem, but MapReduce deals with that too. Thank God. Then you get to perform some other function, which we call the reduce function. And the output of the form, key, comma, new value. And that's all you get to do. You get to decide, what did I tell you? You get to decide what those two functions are and what the output is, essentially, of each step. And it turns out you could do basically anything under this rubric, but you have to do it exactly like this. So let's talk about the word frequency example. The word red in the mapper just sent to the ordered pair, red, comma, one. And then you aggregate the reds together, and then you add up all the ones. That's it. That's word frequency. And we do not have to worry about failure anymore. That's what we get. Cool? So the third part of, and I would love to know how much time I have. Okay. And I want to leave some time for questions, which is why I'm asking. How do you bring these two things together? So I've told you three algorithms. I've told you about MapReduce. So how do you know how to MapReduce our algorithms? And so can we do it? It turns out you can do it, and it's based on something incredibly stupid, which is, well, it's not that stupid. We'll see how stupid it is.
You mean simple.
Yes, simple. Well, it's stupid in the sense that no, and I've met MapReduce gods, okay? I've worked with MapReduce gods, and they're very macho about MapReduce, doing it well, and they would never think about MapReduce this way because they always optimize MapReduce to be very, very efficient. And what I'm saying is a sort of a generic thing you can do that just to prove that it's possible to MapReduce these things. And I'm not a MapReduce god or goddess, So I won't be able to make this stuff optimal, but what I do want to do is convince you guys that you could do this with a large set of data. So the generic simple MapReduce thing is you send some data, and so it's already not that simple because the amount of data you're sending to a given computer has to fit on the computer. Okay, so that's probably the biggest limitation that we should consider. Every time I say we can do this, we have to make sure that the stuff I'm sending isn't arbitrarily large. It has to be some kind of finite thing. And it's always going to come down to the fact a given person hasn't done that much in their history of watching movies or whatever. Have the mapper perform whatever task you want, maybe linear regression. And then the mapper output is just that user ID with the output as the value. And then the fan-in does nothing, well, except it just because really, sending all the user IDs with the same keys, here is just user ID, to the same computer is trivial because there's only one guy here with that ID. The reducer also does nothing, and you just get the answer. So you do all the work in the first function, and the only restriction you have here is that the amount of data you're giving to the first computer has to be limited. Okay, so the factor model, I claim, is parallelizable, which is, and I should have defined this, but what I mean is you can sort of break it up into lots and lots of little jobs and with a limited amount of data, so you can use that thing I just described, that the stupid MapReduce. What happened here? Oh, it was a fade-in. I didn't see that coming. So let's remind ourselves, and I've been told that the key to learning something is to hear it three different times, so I gave you this idea of a factor model, which was like there's latent factors, like the violence or the sentimentality, and then I went back and I told you a little bit more about this, where you have a big matrix X, and you're saying X equals U times V, and remember, we fix U and optimize V, and then we fix V and optimize U. So let's do that. Let's fix a user. What we're doing is we're fixing V, and we're gonna optimize U's coefficients, so the scores. So if you're the user, Rebecca, I keep on pointing at you, sorry. I'm going to optimize your scores, which means I've just adjusted the actual factors themselves, the item values, but now I'm going to pretend the item values are correct. I'm going to make sure that I've got the right scores for your factors, given your history. So I'm going to train, what if you think about that, I'm just training a linear model. If you remember the function I'm minimizing, it's the squared error, right? If I want to minimize the squared error and I'm fixing a user, there's only certain parts of that huge sum of the squared error that I could even possibly touch, namely the part where you're involved, right? So I'm really only minimizing the tiny little part where user Rebecca is involved, which means I'm minimizing the squared error for her. And that's exactly what you're minimizing when you do a linear regression. And so that is what I'm going to do to minimize that squared error. That's a proof, actually. And when you think about it, there's not very many scores for Rebecca, so it's a finite amount of data I'm sending. And I'm putting something under the rug here, which is that a given movie, if I did the other thing, here I'm fixing V and modifying U, but if I fix U and modify V, the sort of dual statement would be a given movie doesn't have that many ratings, which actually is a lie, if you think about it. A given movie, some blockbuster movies have a lot of ratings. And I actually don't know how you do that. I'm gonna guess they take a sample. And I'm gonna do some caveats at the end of this talk, but my guess is they take the recent sample, like as much as they can possibly fit on one computer. I mean, of course, this is all done in a very idiosyncratic way once you've put it on a system. And even Google News isn't really done with the stuff I've been telling you about, I'm sure by now. That paper was written 10 years ago. But, so typically there really is enough to put on one grid, on one computer. And then if you think about the number of coefficients for Rebecca, it's just D coefficients. So I'm inverting a D by D matrix, which is really small because D is 20. So if I similarly fix a movie, there may be quite a few scores, and I'm assuming there's a little fix to that. And everything here is kludgy, you know, like everything done at this scale, there's ways that it broke the system, so they're like, ooh, got to make sure that when there's that much data for that example, then we do something special. I also claim that co-visitation is parallelizable. So remember co-visitation. I'm going to try to remember co-visitation. You have this vector of ones for the articles you read, zeros for not. You've been sent to some random number based on some supposed randomization of all articles, and you get to go to the number which is the value of the first article in your list that you visited. This is actually, I think, not just a parallelizable, this is actually the MapReduce algorithm for co-visitation. So the mapper takes in all the user history, those vectors, and it gives out cluster IDs. Cluster IDs are those concatenated numbers I told you about. So if you have six stories, and you want to think of the people who have that number, are the people in that cluster, are the people who, those first six stories are those six stories. They're quite similar in their history because they've all read those six stories and no other stories before the last number. So you have cluster IDs, you have user IDs as an output. The fan-in collects users, the same key, right? The same user ID. Sorry, the fan-in in this case collects people with the same value. I think I've got it reversed. So now you have clusters with people's, this should have been switched here. So the fan-in collects everybody had the same cluster ID. So what the computer collects in the second half is you have a cluster ID fixed for that computer, and the list, the thing that changes all the users that are in that cluster. And what they do then is they build this something they call the big table that just basically a list of all the clusters with all the users in that cluster. And as I said, in order to make a and you basically you are actually in many more than you have more than one cluster. They do this like six or seven times, or maybe 20 times. And so you, as a person, under 20 different permutations of all stories, you are in 20 different clusters. And they for each cluster, they look at the highly ranked news articles in that cluster that you haven't read, and they actually rank those 20 lists. They then rank those. So you, there's like 20 different ways you could be recommended a good story. And they have pretty complicated ways of deciding which ones. Finally, I claim that latent topic modeling is map reducible. And I didn't really explain the EM algorithm, so I'm not going to really be able to explain this. But it comes down to that the sufficient statistics, which means all you really need to collect in terms of this data, are those probabilities for topics given a user. And there's only 20 topics or something like that. And then the probability of a given article having that being related to that topic. Now, this is actually the kind of the nerdiest version of the MapReduce, because what they do is they take large numbers. The big problem here is that you have too much data, right? So remember, the big thing for the MapReduce is you can't send too much data to one given computer. And this is where you back out how much data to put in based on how big the computer is. Okay, so you have a massive number of users, a massive number of items, and the sufficient statistics are all sitting somewhere. And the question is, how much can you send to one given computer? Well, this is where you take two integers, R and K, which are the dimensions of your grid of computers somewhere in the cloud. And I have a picture here, I believe. Yes. So here are your computers in the cloud. And you're going to get ready for some modular arithmetic. You have k computers by r computers, and you choose r and k, so that hopefully, if you take the user, which is I mod r, the stories that are j mod k, and you go to the I jth computer, you can fit all that stuff onto one computer. And well, that's how you decide how big your grid is, in fact. So you take those, so you slice all the users and all the stories, because they all have IDs, you slice them into small enough slices so that a given square or rectangle can fit onto one computer, and that's how you decide how many computers to have. Okay. And then, by the way, I should have mentioned that once you have the data, the sufficient statistics for that, so it's all fitting on one computer, actually updating the EM algorithm is just sums. It's very simple. But the question is, you know, how many, you know, how much data can you fit onto one computer? Not the actual addition at the end of the day is simple. Okay, so I want to make a few caveats, and then I'm going to pause and ask for questions. So the first thing to mention is that people click on things that they hate. How many people have clicked on that ridiculous ad with a dancing baby? Like I have, just to get rid of it. So a lot of the times that people are, you know, making assumptions about what it means to like something, and they give you more that you've acted on rather than actually said you like. And that has a kind of sinister quality to it, which I think is reasonable. Like, you might have listened to the same song a million times that you hate. You really can't stand it anymore, but they're going to think you love it. Some people are way overrepresented. So if you might have thought about this, but if you go to Netflix and get recommended the wrong movie, it's because your teenage son has been watching way more on Netflix than you have. That happens to me a lot. I'm sure it happens to you, too. But, you know, and that's within your own account, so your actual history is corrupt. But actually, forget about your own history. Who is spending their time on Netflix making movie ratings? Not me. Like, I don't know about you guys, but people with time on their hands. Who answers these questions at Hunch.com? Not me. Okay, I don't have time to answer questions just so they can recommend a laptop for me to buy, which is, like, you know, what they do. And I love those guys, but, like, I don't have time to do that. So who has time to do that are the people that are represented here. So it's not clear that they would understand me in 20 questions, because I don't, and people like me don't answer questions. People may lie. They lie all the time. They want to be the kind of person that can say that. I mean, we know that. Like, there's statistical studies to measuring how much people lie. So in particular, if you have Hunch.com asking you, are you a good person or a bad person? You know, like something like that. I'm a good person, you know. So there's that. Missing information is a problem. So, for example, on Spotify, they have a history of what you listen to on Spotify. They don't, like, you only listen to Spotify when you're at work and you cannot dance. Yes or no? Like, when I'm at home, I listen to, like, you know, I listen to whatever my kids listen to, but so that's real missing information. They really don't have an actual profile of your taste because you only deal with them in certain situations. And that's a really bigger question. And it also goes to this question of, which I'm not mentioning on this, but I'll throw it in, this filter bubble question, which is that people recommend to you stuff that they think works for this environment, and then you never get exposed to something outside that environment which you would probably really like or might really like. But the algorithm is self-fulfilling. It has a self-fulfilling prophecy element to it, which is that it only recommends things that it's sort of sure you'll like, and it never introduces you to other things. And you can ask, and I think you should ask, what kind of cultural effect does that have on us as a whole if we're just blindly walking around being recommended by recommendation engines that are just using histories of our own experience. I personally would like to have new experiences every now and then. Another thing is that new people are a problem. That's very related to this idea that you don't have a history before you enter this universe of Netflix or Spotify. And how do they recommend, how do you as an engineer recommend things to new people? And finally, seasonality is a problem for data. This stuff moves very quickly. Movies less so than songs, but songs are big hits. How do you deal with that if you're an engineer? You don't have a, you know, I don't have a history of listening to this song, but everyone loves this song right now. So should they introduce that to me or not, considering that it doesn't look obvious that I would like it, but maybe I would like it. So those are a bunch of caveats that are dealt with, obviously, in different ways for different situations. And that's what's cool about being a data scientist. You have to be scrappy. And I want to thank you very much. Thank you.